your letter.
The meeting will come to order, and before we approve the minutes and go into our day's agenda, Representative Garofalo has an announcement and actually an invitation to members of our committee. So I hope you'll give him your full attention. Representative Garofalo.
Well, breaking news, Chair Greiling has graciously agreed to step aside and let me chair the committee. That was...
No.
In the middle of February, the NCSL has a education finance summit in Denver, Colorado. I believe, I don't have a calendar with me, but I believe the days are, February 16th to the 18th. It actually works well. It begins... you fly out on a Friday, you come back on a Sunday, and even though we don't have our travel or committee budgets or anything like that, I'm planning on attending, and it would sure be nice if there's anyone else in the committee who'd be interested in attending and going out there, so I'm not the only member from the Minnesota delegation. I don't know if anyone else is interested or not. If you go to the NCSL website, they've got something there. If you want more information, come talk to me about it. But I think it's a good learning experience in terms of figuring out what other states do right, what other states do wrong, learn from the mistakes of others. So, and Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. And again, if anyone's interested, please talk to me after the meeting.
Thank you very much. And if anybody is interested, in addition to talking to Representative Garofalo after the committee, also talk to Representative Sertich's office, because the House does have a budget for members of the legislature to have a chance to attend these very worthwhile events. And Representative Garofalo has already been approved, and it seems only fitting that another member hopefully will take advantage of this and be able to go with him. So if you're interested, talk to Representative Sertich's office about going, because they're the ones that have the budget on how many members can travel. We don't have our committee budget yet, and when I checked on it earlier today, they said we would have it by the end of the month, or end of next month, actually. So there is a quorum present, and so I would entertain a motion for the minutes of January 17th.
Okay.
Representative Erickson,
thank you, Chair. I'll move the minutes of the January 18th meeting.
Thank you very much.
January 17th.
Thank you very much. Representative Erickson corrected her motion even before I could do that. And she moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion of her motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are approved. And we will now go on to the agenda. And members, next week we are going to get the governor's budget and be having the commissioner come in on our Tuesday meeting. We're going to start going through the budget book and working very hard to figure out what's in it and then to figure out our committee priorities for our House bill. So today is our really last day to have a broad-ranging discussion for quite a while of the larger topics, and I think we have a treat before us. We have invited in the new dean of the University of Minnesota Education Department, Darlene Bailey, and I would invite her to come up to the table right at this moment. And she has brought with her a whole group of talented and research knowledgeable University of Minnesota professionals that she will introduce to us. And then each of them has a topic assignment and will talk to us for about 5 minutes. And then we have a chance to ask them questions for about 5 minutes. And then at the end, if we have time, we can have the whole group respond to questions. And I will turn it over to Dr. Bailey.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for inviting us to be a part of this very timely and critically important conversation. We have come today to share with you our perspectives based on many years of research and many years of studying the best practice models that are out there, some of which are in Minnesota, others around this country. And as Madam Chair said, we will then entertain questions for clarification and questions for hopefully a lively conversation toward the end. I want to just initially introduce my colleagues to you, and this will be the order of presentation for today. Professor Kathy Jordan, Long Zhang, Arthur Reynolds, Jillian Rowick, Deborah Dillon. Please know in this, the new College of Education and Human Development, we have about 195 other colleagues back sitting in the building, anxiously awaiting to hear how this conversation went. We are indeed the second largest college at the new U. Okay, let me begin, and I'm going to sit down.
Okay. I was asked to share a little bit about why I left Columbia University and came here to the U. In fact, I have to tell you, that was the most frequently asked question when I came here. And to me, it was very simple. And so the following presentation, that was my part for right now, is looking at going from the dean's dream to the college's mission. The faculty, students, and staff embraced the vision that I presented, M to the power of 3. Originally called it 3M, and then quickly realized there was already a company here by that name. So it's M to the power of 3, talking about the synergy, the integration, and the power that comes from three core elements of this, our new college. The first is multidisciplinary. Multidisciplinary we define as spanning multiple fields of research and teaching to create new ways of seeing and enacting. Essentially, units in the former College of Human Ecology, the former General College, and the former College of Education were all brought together and therefore represent multiple disciplinary fields, purposely brought together so that all of what we do in the classroom, all of what we do in terms of our community partnerships and our areas of research will be structured to fulfill this part of our mission. My own professional background is in the area of psychiatric social work from Columbia University, a business degree from Case Western University in organizational behavior, and then spinning over to Teachers College, where I was vice president of academic affairs and dean until now, dean and the assistant to the president, working with Bob Brunick on several system-wide initiatives. So in short, I am the very proud founding dean of the new College of Education and Human Development, which has been created to transform the way that higher education serves the world. The next M is multicultural. Multicultural speaks to honoring not only the differences that exist between and among people, but also the similarities. Moving from a we and a them perspective to an us and a we perspective and practice, including but going beyond the demographics of race and gender and lifestyle, politics and religion, include divergent perspectives and divergent schools of thought and practice. Our goal is to ensure that our students are exposed, for example, to the continuum of political ideologies. To use language that we have all gotten comfortable with if we want to categorize ourselves, the continuum from liberal to moderate centrist to conservative. Using the same M3 to talk about myself, suffice it to say that I was raised and remain part of a family that identifies as African American. Yet, as my mom would say frequently, we're a mixture of all God's good things. Personally, I am liberal in my life philosophies and practices, yet fiscally very conservative. Last M, the model. We look at our college as a model for transformative, sustainable, and replicable public engagement. What we've been doing since October 2nd, when I joined the college, to first go out, listen to and listen for the needs of our communities, then pull them together and align our resources with the needs and the assets of our community colleagues. There's a theologian, Frederick Buchner, who once said that amazing things happen in our lives and indeed in our work when our deep gladness meets the world's deep needs. And that's kind of the credo of what we plan on doing in terms of not just our mission statement, but the way we live into and up to our mission. And for me, this is precisely why I came to Minnesota. Minnesota, as you all know, has a very long legacy of forward-thinking educational achievement. And I've just bulleted
what I thought were four exemplars of that. And I won't go through them because you know them all very well. But I dare say, even in Harlem, New York, the achievements of Minnesota are quite well known. However, it doesn't mean that we can't do things better in the area of education. Despite these achievements, and despite the achievements of other states, the academic achievement gap between students of color and their white counterparts is larger than it was almost 20 years ago. In fact, the racial achievement gap is symbolic of a larger issue. Therefore, this is much bigger than just education. Mr. and Mrs. Drs. Thernstrom spoke about the racial gap being actually the main source of ongoing racial inequality in this country. As we all know, racial inequality is America's yet-to-be-finished business, the wound that remains unhealed. And I would suggest to you that it's not just in this country alone. But I am confident that if we pull like-minded people in goals around the table, that we can indeed have Minnesota be the place to set the model for the country, and this country step up, reclaim its leadership role as a model for the rest of the world. In fact, the education achievement gap is a dilemma. It isn't a problem with a right and a wrong answer. It isn't something with an easy, single-focused magic bullet. Rather, the education achievement gap reflects competing needs and competing truths. It reflects multiple disparities that go beyond the classroom, impacting families and communities as well. In short, we believe, and hopefully by the end of the time we have together today, you will also agree with us, that interventions to address the educational achievement gap must be bold, must be grounded in what we know, meaning evidence-based, grounded in all the good research that has gone on and research that we are conducting at this point in time, to enable Minnesota to provide a model for the rest of the nation, if not the world. Okay, so the stage is set. Unless there are any questions for clarification, we are going to continue to move then through our best thinking while we keep in mind our allotted time period. Again, you should feel very free to ask questions. Start with Kathy. Dr. Jordan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I'm Dr. Kathy Jordan. I'm a member of the pediatrics faculty at the university, a pediatric neuropsychologist by training, and I'm the executive director of the Children, Youth, and Family Consortium at the U. We're an outreach center that aims, in part anyway, to bring evidence-based information to practitioners and policymakers. The consortium has adapted a research-based model for understanding child and family functioning called the ecological model, and we have adapted this specifically for understanding the achievement gap. Actually, we need to move to my... There we go. So what I'd like to do in the next 5 minutes or so, and this is my charge or my role for this part of the presentation, is to review this adaptation that we call the Circles of Influence for understanding contributions to the achievement gap, and to provide some illustrations of how you might use this in guiding decision-making or policy-making about strategies to close the gap. First, I'm going to do a little clarification about terminology or vocabulary. I'm going to use the phrase achievement gap. We probably all will. It's a commonly used word. But it does have a specific connotation. It is about outcomes. It's about the difference between groups in things like test scores, something you hear a lot about. But it's broader than that. It's also about grades and retention rates and readiness for higher education and the workplace. There's another phrase, educational disparities, which is a useful term because it also brings in the idea of causes, the inequities that lead some children to learn differently or achieve at different rates. So to address the achievement gap and strategies to close it, it's very important to understand what factors influence its occurrence or what are those educational disparities. The circle of influence framework is one that I think can be helpful in understanding this complex interplay between child, family, school, community, and policy influences on child learning and on the achievement gap. You have in your packet a newsletter from the Children's and Family Consortium, and in the middle of it there is a pull-out insert that is a very detailed example of an application of the ecological model to the issue of the educational achievement gap. I'm going to use this more sort of generic version just for sort of illustration purposes. The child is at the center of this network of circles here, and they bring to it everything they're born with. They bring to it their way of responding to the world. But then there are a series of circles of influence, things that influence their learning, their behavior, their development, and when we apply this to the achievement gap, influences the development of the achievement gap. The first one is informal supports. And these are the folks that are most intimately and immediately involved in influencing the child's development and learning. Obviously the family, siblings, extended family, maybe neighbors. It's about the quality of their relationships. It's also about the quality of the home environment. The second layer, community, is a step removed, and it's more about agencies and institutions and sometimes systems. It's about access to and the quality of the resources there, the quality of those relationships, and the physical and emotional environment within those agencies. The next circle is the policymaking circle, and what I want you to remember at this point is simply that policymaking is influenced by all of the other circles and influences all of the other circles of influence, and we'll come back to that point in a minute. And then the last circle is society or cultural influences, and these are big picture things, beliefs, cultural practices, and ubiquitous things like the media. The take-home point here is that the achievement gap is sort of at the center, the child, and it is influenced by a complex interaction of all of these other circles of influence. Every one of those circles influences the other, and vice versa. Now, how might you use this in decision-making about the achievement gap? Oftentimes what happens in policymaking is that policy is directed towards the community circle, let's say schools, in the hope that it will affect the child and their learning. But that effectively skips over an important circle, the informal supports layer. That actually has a name in the literature. It's called the donut effect, like the donut hole. It's missing. A goal for policymaking around the achievement gap might be to take advantage of those naturally occurring interactions between these circles of influence and purposefully try to pull them together, try to pull in, for instance, the informal support layer in policymaking. And I'm going to give you a couple of examples of how that might happen. One I call community as vehicle, and that's when policymaking is targeted at the community circle, but it's meant to support the informal support layer. It's meant to support the families in their attempt to support their child's education. An example might be the federal policy about workplaces allowing their parents to take part in their child's education by attending conferences, volunteering, otherwise taking part in their children's education. The policy is geared towards the community level, the workplace, but it's for the express purpose of supporting the parents in supporting their child's education. Another example is really about building a partnership between different layers or different circles of influence. In this case, let's take the example of policymakers making appropriations to school districts so that they can create positions for parental involvement coordinators in every district. Again, it's targeted at the community circle of influence, the school, but it's for the express purpose of building a partnership between that layer, the community layer, and the parental layer in order to help the child achieve. So these are two examples of strategies in policymaking that could take advantage of this natural interaction between informal supports and communities, etc. Closing a couple of take-home points here, my main point is that the achievement gap is a very complex issue that is influenced by multiple interacting factors. So strategies that focus only on one of the circles of influence or a factor within it are not likely to be successful because they're not taking into account all of the other causal factors. So there are no magic bullets, and you kind of need to guard against being sucked in by some of those magic bullets. What we need are multi-pronged strategies, meaning they cross over multiple circles of influence, strategies that are well-coordinated and that are grounded in a holistic understanding of the child. What we are going to do now is have some faculty presentations. Before I sort of set the stage for how that's going to happen, are there questions that I can answer? Okay. What we're going to do next is have several faculty members that are going to present research and their policy implications. We're going to organize this essentially according to the circles of influence. We're going to start in sort of that family or informal supports layer, and then we're going to move to the more community or school layer. Our first presenter is Dr. Blong Zhang.
Thank you to Dr. Jordan and Dr. Zhang.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for having my colleagues and my college to give you a little insight about what the perspective of the academics on achievement gap, and what I am going to do is walk you through with some of the research that I have done over the past years, and then also review of other work that would have give us some promising practices as we approach this huge complex issues. So I think when we deal with the achievement gap or any other type of outcome in our children, we need to look at this as a very complex issue, as Dr. Jordan was just mentioned. But because this type of theoretical model is so complex, we have to put it in work with the real people. And when we talk about the achievement gap, essentially, as the dean was talking about, there is a disparity between ethnic minority and then the Caucasian population. And so when you're talking about the SES, separation between poor and then a more affluent community, and if you look at that context, within the family itself, the family environment, what I call, you have this hierarchical needs, where you have the basic needs, you have the personal family needs, and then the child needs. We all assume that every parent wants the children to be successful, and every parent have an interest of the child, but oftentimes in this type of family, the child often become a second or third priority in the family, because the basic needs, the personal family needs, become a more priority issues. And so we have to, what we do is really trying to be able to look at the research and help our parents in the family context to understand the importance of the child in order to deal with this achievement gap. So let me walk you through with a few of the data that I put together to give us some sense of how the family environment actually impacts this achievement gap. You know, and I don't have to tell the members of the committee that in Minnesota, as well as across the country, that there's a significant gap between the rich and the poor, and particularly Caucasian American and ethnic minority population, as shown on these two graphs. Ethnic groups have lower rates of adults with at least a high school diploma in the Twin Cities metro. For example, 45% of the Hmong population, who actually make up about 30% of our St. Paul public schools population, actually have completed high school, so we have a tremendous gaps in some of these larger forces. And if you look at jobs in the metro area, Caucasian population tend to have jobs in higher paying occupation compared to ethnic minority population. And we know through research that two of the most robust predictors of children's academic performance are actually families' SES and then families' education. Level of education. And so we have a lot of challenges ahead of us. Now we also have in this whole process of being poor and then trying to raise the best children possible, parents have shifted their parenting styles and parenting skills in the process. Oftentimes parents will have to work two jobs, two shifts in order to provide for the family. And then oftentimes, parents will have to switch a shift so that so that the father would work in third shift and the mother would work in first shift. And then even though the father came home, stay with the children, physically there, but psychologically wasn't there. And so we know that. And that actually impact in this type of parenting style, what we call in family social science and child development, the unengaged and then authoritarian parents. Those are the two type of parenting that have the most significant impact in our achievement gaps, if you look at across the country. And so, I think it's significant in order to deal with this achievement gap, you have to look at the needs of the family and be able to look at the parenting skills and parenting styles. If we only concentrate on parents' parenting skills without looking at the larger issues, I think we're missing something. I do apologize for not shifting to the slide, but this is the slide. And then let me go into the next slide, which is long research that talks exactly about what I just presented earlier with the Hmong population. And if you look at the Hmong population, they're very a unique special case for a lot of the other ethnic minority in Minnesota, where they have low SES. 33% of them actually live below the federal poverty line. They're also struggling in with the English language. Many of the children, indeed, 30% of the children actually enroll in the ELL program. And many of these families are also working in different shifts. And when I did this study a couple years ago, we found that parental monitoring, again, lack of monitoring, play a significant role in children's academic performance and then in delinquent behaviors, particularly in problem behaviors where young people would use alcohol, drugs, fist fights, and then involve in gangs. And we also know that attachment, for example, young people who report that they do have some attachment with their parents actually did much, much better, were able to protect themselves from delinquent activities, at one school. And so we understand that authoritarian and unengaged parents serve a terrible job for young people, and we know the parents are really wanting to, for their children to be successful, so we have to create programs and support systems to support our young particular parents who do not have access to resources. I apologize, SES is actually socioeconomic status, just looking at the family income. So I do apologize for using some acronym without defining it.
We throw those around here, too.
I use St. Paul Public School as an example. Again, I do not meant to pick on St. Paul Public School, but if you look at St. Paul Public School, and then of course if you look at the Minneapolis Public School, you see very similar trend, where we have an increase of significant of our young people of color into the school system. And more than 60% of those students of color are actually coming from poor families. And so when we talk about the achievement gap, we often referring to children who are going into urban school settings. A school where we have significant students who are poor. And so I think we have to be able to think thoroughly through this whole process, because the achievement gap, again, as I said, is a manifestation of this complex dialectical processes. From multiple sources. So I think it's important as we move forward and looking at some of these data, the last couple of data that I want to show you are actually taken from the Minnesota Department of Education by the Institute on Race and Poverty at the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota. And this data that I should actually show you that as a percentage of poor and students of color increases, the performance, the graduation rates in this case actually decrease. In other words, the more that we have people who are coming from poor families, the more challenges we are actually presenting to our teachers, to our school setting. And so to be able to say, pointing fingers to the school and saying that they are not doing their job is actually an excuse on our part, because we are actually sending a lot of people who are underprepared and also highly stressful into the school setting. I do not have the data with me, but if you want, you could actually, I could send you the data. If you look at, again, also the disruptive behaviors that are reported by school system across the Minnesota, and you can actually, as you can see, St. Paul, Minneapolis also have the highest school disruptive when you have this type of student. So it's again, it's very critical for us to look at not only just looking at the desegregation, as some people call it, that actually impacts the performance, but actually looking at, again, the interaction between the family environment and then what the school can do. There's also another data set that I also want to show you, a very similar process trend, where you have as poverty students' enrollment increases, their performance actually decreases, very similar with the graduation rate. And I want to spend about a couple minutes on the last slide, because I think it's important as we talk about so what. And a lot of us researchers are not very good at this part, because we like to do a lot of our research and then manipulate the data, but we don't oftentimes take the time to think about implications so that people could use this implication to be able to work with the real people. And as I work with different school systems over the years, I think what we are missing is a stronger linkages among family, school, and other service agencies. Oftentimes, many of our services are segmented, including the family. And so we have to have these strong linkages. For example, we know a lot of the out-of-school time research has continued to document that many of our poor ethnic minority students who are actually falling behind tend to fall behind during the summer, where they do not have access to quality summer program. And so I think it's very important for us to continue to have continual program throughout the years for young people to be able to access so that we could continue to have that intervention for young people. Children who are coming from diverse family backgrounds and families with lots of needs tend to be very stressful and isolated. We know that. Research at the Oregon State University have found and continue to find that, again, poor people of color students who are rejected by both the peers and teachers and then in the community tend to do the worst in their academic performance. And so we need to be able to think about a different type of climate for young people, especially urban settings where we have more than 70% of our students who are people of color. We need to be able to create the type of climate where we would welcome every type of students, regardless of how they look, and whether or not they actually fit the stereotype or label. I think we have to have that type of climate. And we have to consider focusing on intensifying the interpersonal relationship. Research over the past few years have found that a strong bond between teachers and students, and then, of course, among students, tend to protect a lot of young people from delinquent activities and improve academic performance. So I think we have to focus on building the type of relationship in the school setting along with the climate so that multiple ethnic minority students are more likely to be able to commit into the school settings. And through that, I think we need to consider focusing on staff, teachers, education, and training that work with this type of very different population. We have people of color in the past, but we have never had this type of students who are coming into our environment where they are very independent and very articulated and want everything fast and right away. Our traditional program could not teach us to deal with this type of students. And I think we ought to focus our resources to this type of program so that we have better teachers. And lastly, I also want to point out about the parent education. I know that people are busy and really trying to meet their needs But parent education is very important, and I think we need to engage parents in a very different way. Rather than setting up ECFE, which is early childhood family education, and the whole idea that if you build it, people will come, and we know that you build it, people won't come. And so we have to be able to be more engaged with the community and spread family and parent education to a wider audience so that we could impact a lot of these hard-to-reach families. That's all I have to say, unless if you have any other questions for this very, again, very rush and short presentation. If you want additional resources, again, feel free to ask, and I'll forward the resources back to you.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor. I loved your presentation, the fact that you really dwell upon the importance of the parents in education. And I loved your reference to the Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
But I do have a question, all right? If you had the opportunity to change education within the state of Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
what one thing would you do
mm-hmm.
with your field of expertise and all of your research?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Dr. Sean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and then again, member of the committee. If I have a choice and a chance to use what I know from the research perspective and really trying to build and reform our school system, I think there has to be a strong linkages between schools and then the various social institutions. As I mentioned earlier, we know that a lot of our students who are falling behind or falling behind tend to either lack behind before third grade or during the adolescent years, where many of them, again, went in through the summer and then came back and then lost significant of their scores.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you could build a system where students are able to go right into a service if they have a problem with homework. Yeah. And I often use this story, and I do apologize for a little long, but I have four children, and three of them are actually in grade 3, 5, and then, of course, 7.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my wife has a high school diploma, and my wife cannot help my children at all. And one day I came home, and my daughter would say, "Dad, you know what? If you and mom decide to divorce, I'm going to go with you." And I said, interesting. Why? And of course she said, "Well, mom cannot help me."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Uh-huh. Now, just assume that a lot of kids out there like my daughter, who are coming home every day, and there's no dad, or there's nobody like me to come home and help them. Do we have a service? Do we have the resources to support these young people? And I think we don't. And if we could do that, I think throughout the year, I think we do our job, at least transforming the way we run our school system.
Thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question was very similar to Representative Heidgerken's. I want to compliment you on your work. I think it's very insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And my question was very similar, so I'm not going to go any further and ask another one, but I was interested in Dr. Zhang's interpretation of some of the policies and some of the things that we do and how it relates, but I think you answered that very well, so thank you.
Right. Thank you.
And members, one thing that the university, thank you, always offers is anytime we're working on legislation, and we, of course, have our wonderful staff here to work with, but they have actually a clearinghouse number that I hope Dr. Bailey will leave with us at the end, where we can actually call them, and they can tell us what research might back up or steer a good idea that we have, that, and then we have a better way to convince each other that it's a good idea if there actually is some research that shows that it works. I had one question for Dr. Shang, and then we also have Representative Garofalo. My question is, yesterday the governor came out with his agenda, and we haven't seen the details yet, but he had a 2% increase for all schools on general formula, and then schools that achieve, based on the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment 2 test,
mm-hmm.
A certain score, then if their school gets 3 stars based on that test, then they would get another 2%. And I was listening to what you were saying about the challenge of some students and that it's not always just the school that is accountable for some of the challenges that the students have. And I wondered if you could comment on that second 2% based on if a school got 3 stars on their report card, and that a lot of that is due to how the students did on a single test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's one of the key disconnects between research and policy policy work. I think we have to be able to get a good handling on this type of work and be able to look at just MCA, which is Minnesota Comprehensive Test, or some any other standardized test, and be able to say, are we measuring what we intend to measure, and how can we support children and families and community so that we don't penalize our schools or reward a school indeed, a school that a place in the neighborhood or in a place where they are able to attract a lot of students who are coming from higher SES. Mm-hmm. And then penalize schools that are actually located in a poor neighborhood. And they have 80 to 90% of the students are coming from these poor families and neighborhoods where teachers are doing everything that they can. But, of course, there are a lot of challenges. So I think we ought to look at this very seriously before we make any decisions. And last thing, I often tell stories to my students that a lot of these tests, If I take these tests, I would probably be I would also be failing some of these tests. I came here when I was 14, and I did not have any English at all. And of course, during that time in the 80s, there were no standardized tests except taking ACT and SAT, and I did poorly on those. But I was able to function normally. And so I think we have to be able to look at different measurement, different types of competencies and life skills. To be able to say, are we, or have we done enough for students? Now, these achievement gap that we see from our state department and then various schools, are they really measuring our students' competencies, or are they following the guidelines of the national standard or some other standards where they actually standardize on white, middle-class, affluent school districts? And so I think there's still a lot of questions to be asked. I'm not the right person to answer some of these questions, but again, a long answer to your question. I think there needs to be a connection between policy and research.
Thank you very much. And the last question for Dr. Shung, Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, you have a slide here linking, and it states linking family environment to school performance.
Mm-hmm.
As part of your data collection, do you have a correlation factor between the number of parents in the family
mm-hmm.
and school performance, so linking, I guess, the actual
mm-hmm.
Between
yes.
that and performance versus just money?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shung.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and of course, again, members of the committee. I do not have the large data set, but my colleagues across the nation do have these type of data on the number of parents in the household and how that actually influenced children's performance. So we do have, again, longitudinal research, and I am sure Dr. Renner will address a little bit of that when he talked about his longitudinal study. But yes, we do have those type of data available.
Madam Chair, under the testifier,
and
I realize you don't have this in front of you, but in terms of assessing a correlation factor, is there a higher correlation based off of poverty or a higher correlation based off of the number of parents in the household?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shung.
Thank you. Some study actually control for income level, and even controlling for income level, parenting still plays a significant role, especially single parenting, single parenthood plays a significant role in the process. And in pure English, it means that parenting plays a significant role. But I think many of the quantitative research, what we talked about in research, actually ignore the real life situation. If you are poor, statistically, if you control for income, you still live in a poor neighborhood and you still live in there for years, and that actually impact your parenting. And because I grew up from a poor family, I understand that you live in poor McDonald home in St. Paul for the past 15 years, and suddenly you go out and work, and now your income is a little higher. That doesn't really change the way you do your parenting, the way you relate to your children, because you have those survival strategies, what I call it, for so long that it becomes a part of your family. And so, again, we do have some data on poor families and how they use survival strategies, for example, fake divorce so that they could get benefits. Yeah. And that become a part of the process of socialization. And so we do have a lot of data. And again, if a member of the community would like to have some of these data, I will be glad to forward it to my dean, and then my dean will forward it to you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and the testifier, if we see four school districts here, I'm assuming that there's a larger data set than that. If the members of the committee, if we could have, I'm just envisioning a correlation between poverty and school performance, and then a crosstab based on the number of parents in the household, if that data existed, I think it would be interesting for the committee to take a look at that. That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Shong and Dr. Bailey. Who is our next star?
Our next star is Dr. Arnold Reynolds. Arnold, where did that come from? Arthur. My dad's name. How did I go to Arnold?
That's where it came from.
Thank you for having me here. I'm Arthur Reynolds. I work at the Institute of Child Development in the college. And in the next few minutes, I just want to summarize some of the work going on in the early childhood development field. You know, some of the major themes from the research and some of the implications that you might want to look for in terms of implications for policy. You know, to summarize the themes of looking at the impact of early childhood education, I think, you know, states around the country have been working on early childhood for, you know, for decades, and it's a top priority. So a main question comes up, why is early childhood such a top priority? And I think there are three major reasons that aren't true of other social programs that we need to talk about. One is that if we look at the effects of preschool programs, early childhood programs, that the positive effects are broad and enduring. In other words, they impact not only school readiness and achievement, but they also impact educational attainment, crime, and social-emotional development. So the broad domains, so they affect many domains of child development over long periods of time, and that these effects, they last over time. Kids that participate in high-quality preschool programs beginning at age three or, you know, within a family system, that they have long-enduring effects 10 to 15 years after the end of program participation. In the latest of one study, the high school parent preschool program, these effects endured up to the age of 40. I think the second reason that early childhood is the top priority is the cost effectiveness is high. Been a number of cost benefit analyses of early childhood programs. You know, for every dollar that's invested in the programs, the range of return runs from about $3 to $10 per dollar invested in terms of the return on investment. That would be up to about a 900% return on investment for every dollar invested. So I think that's a second feature. And most other education and social programs don't have near the same return. And the last thing is, it gets to the achievement gap. The impacts of early childhood programs for children at risk are greater than for other kids. So if we give a high-quality early childhood education program to those children of color or those that are high-poverty children, the effect of the experience on their development will be greater than it will be for other kids, middle-class kids, kids not of color. And so that speaks to, I think, the importance of early childhood education to not only address the achievement gap, but also to improve the well-being of kids over time. And I think if we look at just that, the point about return economic benefits of early education, let me just highlight the available evidence that exists of all social programs from birth to the age of 18 gives you a pattern of evidence that is what I present here. Now, I want you to look not just at the individual numbers, but the trend, that you see that interventions, and this is the return per dollar invested. So $1 invested, the payback you expect is at least $1.01. Anything beyond that, of course, is great. But the goal is to get a return that's over a dollar. And you can see here that based on the available cost-benefit analysis that have been done of different social programs, that the largest return on investment comes in programs in the first 5 years of life. And then after preschool, it's not that return on investment, it can't be positive, that you can't have cost-effective programs, but the odds are much lower. So when you compare the economic benefit of reducing class size in the elementary grades versus preschool programs, then you see that the return is much higher. You get a bigger bang for the buck if you invest in programs in the first 5 years of life. What this chart doesn't speak to, of course, is that if you align these programs over time, if you give kids not just the WIC supplemental feeding program in infancy, but also a preschool program and then reduce class size in early elementary grades, you're going to have a synergy there of experiences that are going to have a more lasting effect. That's unaddressed in the research, and I think that's one direction that I think is important for policymakers to understand. There's a synergy among experiences if you get different high-quality intervention programs. Now, what are the common elements of the programs that show high economic returns? I think there's six that I can summarize from the research, and this is work over the last five decades, and I'm kind of boiling this down to five or six points. One is that the opportunity to participate for more than 1 year. Programs that are more effective, they tend to provide more than just 1 year of intervention. It's usually opportunities for at least two or more years of intervention. So that would mean preschool programs beginning at age three as opposed to just age four. Second, well-trained and compensated teachers. Teachers that have bachelor's degrees and are certified in early ed are associated with greater benefits of programs. Small class sizes and small child-to-staff ratios are another key feature. In the programs that show the highest levels of economic benefits, the highest class size in those programs is 17. The instruction is both diverse and literacy-rich, that there's opportunities for lots of stimulating curriculum and interactions, both play and outside classroom activities. Comprehensive services are tailored to the needs of the families. And many of the programs, and most of the programs that show these large economic returns, it's not just a teacher in a classroom with kids. It is providing a network of services, parent involvement services, health services, programs, the kind of a profile program that you see in programs like Head Start and others. That these comprehensive services add value above and beyond the classroom experience that kids have. That's another key feature of these economic returns. The last one is the cost per child. Now, of the cost-benefit analysis have been done, the lowest cost per child of any of the high-quality programs that lead to these long economic returns is $5,000 per child for a half-day program. That's the minimum standard based on the evidence from the economic analyses. Now, I'm not going to go through the chart. How does early childhood lead to these long-term effects? There's a process of impact on different individual and family systems that I won't go toward. Just to give you kind of a flavor that there's a process, that it isn't magic how early childhood affects these long-term outcomes into development, into later development. Now, if we look at the learning gap, now I want to get the issues about, in Minnesota, let's look at kids being ready for school. And in Minnesota, the Department of Education does do a developmental battery that's based on a well-known work sampling method of looking at kind of readiness for kindergarten. And based on what the Minnesota Department of Education reports, what percentage of the Minnesota kindergartners that are sampled on this survey are not ready for kindergarten based on a language and literacy. In the fall of 2004, based on the work sampling methodology, you know, over a sample of about 3,000 kids that was kind of stratified to kind of match the characteristics of the state at large, 13% of all Minnesota kindergartners were not yet ready, were not ready for kindergarten in the language literacy domain. And of course, that varied dramatically by individual child and family characteristics. The kids that were least ready and not ready, the highest level of non-readiness or unreadiness or not being ready was kids in families where the parent didn't have a high school degree. 31%. Compared to kids in a family where the parent was a college graduate, only 6% of those kids were not ready based on the assessment. So you can see the great difference, one by income. If you look at income, there's a big gap by income. Kids and families where the income is less than $35,000 a year, there's about a 16-point gap in the level of unreadiness, not yet being ready for kindergarten. And so I think, can early intervention impact those gaps is the question. The answer is yes. In my studies and looking at the long-term effects of the Chicago Child Parent Center program, that's a preschool center-based program in the Chicago Public Schools, I direct you to the charts here. You look at the, let's look at the impact on school readiness skills. So kids in the comparison group were at the 28th percentile on a nationally normed test in the fall of kindergarten. So that sure would have been the standard. Can a program, an innovative program like Child Parent Centers, give you something more than that? The average percentile score on the school readiness battery was the 47th percentile for kids in the Child Parent Center program. What percentage of the kids in each group were at national norms? 47% of the kids in the preschool program, these are high-risk kids, compared to 25% in the comparison group. So that's a 22% difference. So that gap, we can narrow the gap by those 22 points in terms of being at national norms by kindergarten. So the point here is that I think that preschool, although it can't close the gap completely, it can make a significant dent up to 50 or 60% in closing the gap by the time school, by the kid is in kindergarten. And that speaks to what is Minnesota doing as far as early childhood policy in providing access to programs for four-year-olds. As you can see here, I've charted out, and this is from the National Institute of Early Education Research, publishes every year kind of a yearbook on preschool in the different states. And on the metric of the percentage of kids in Minnesota, the percentage of four-year-olds that participate in a government-funded preschool program, 18% of Minnesota four-year-olds participate in a government-funded preschool program, either state-funded or federal-funded, such as Head Start. 18%, which ranks us 45th out of 50 states in access to government-funded preschool programs across the states. Our neighbor, our near neighbor, in contrast, has almost 50% of their kids that participate in their four-year-old kindergarten program that's run based on a school funding formula reimbursement. In other states, you can see. Not a happy story. But I think in looking at the larger ecological context that Kathy talked about, we also need to understand that we really believe, and this is a quote from Ed Ziegler, one of the founders of Head Start, do we really believe that a year of preschool can ultimately shape the course of human life? To do so is to ignore the many, many factors ranging from the quality of schools to socialization influences from the family and the community. So obviously what I'm arguing is that early childhood can make a very big difference in kids' life. It can help narrow the achievement gap, but it's not going to be the be-all and end-all. It's not going to be an inoculation against continuing disadvantage. And that's why I think emerging in early childhood education, you have this movement to organize and align different programs and services within the early childhood period. And there's a movement called PK3, that means preschool to third grade, so that when we think about early childhood, we're not just thinking about preschool, we're thinking about how kids from preschool transition into kindergarten, how kids from kindergarten transition into first and second and third grade, and to provide more continuous, comprehensive experiences for kids and that that is an important element for looking at early childhood. It's not just about preschool. It's about providing school-stable, community-stable learning experiences across those very important years in kids' lives. So I'll stop there for questions.
Representative Benson.
I did not have a question. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. I thought earlier you were raising your hand, getting on the list. Okay. Does anyone have a question? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reynolds, right?
Yeah.
I didn't look. I just guessed. Anyway, I'm interested in the slide about 45th out of 50 states in pre-K access for four-year-olds in 2005. How long has that been the case?
How long?
Dr. Reynolds.
45th?
Yeah.
Dr. Reynolds.
I think it's been a consistent pattern. The yearbook, the near yearbook, has been done since the early, I think it began in 2001. So that's been consistent in the last few years. Prior to that, rankings just started in 2001 based on the yearbook, the publication date. I think the first year was 2001. So the Minnesota relative ranking has been very consistent from that time. Prior to that, that hasn't really been documented.
Follow-up, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question then, I mean, we've ranked very high in ACTs and a lot of nationally normed comparisons, if you will. How do we correlate our low standing in the pre-K access for four-year-olds with the assumption that is going to lead to better achievement with us being low there and high achievement after they graduate? And maybe we can't correlate that yet, and maybe that's going to come. Do you have any thoughts on that?
A couple things. The ACT and SAT is a very, very selective sample to take them. It's college-going kids, those interested in college, so only 50-60% of high school students, if they're still in school at that time, would take the test. So I think it's a very, very select sample. But as you take them, if you look at the achievement level of all kids, I think you wouldn't necessarily correlate it. But the way I look at it is that performance of kids on tests, high school tests, very standardized tests, would be even better if kids, all kids from different socioeconomic circumstances, had the capacity, the available access to preschool programs, so that more kids are at risk would be more likely to continue into high school, so they'd be able to take or would be interested in taking the ACT or the SAT. So I think it's a limiting factor that you want more access, and then by increasing access, increasing quality in early childhood, you then would both increase the number of kids that take those tests and also the score on those tests. So I see it as something that would make our state performance even better than it currently is.
Representative Dominguez, Representative Morrow, and then we all go on because we've got two more people. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reynolds, in your common elements showing high economic returns and your instruction, the diverse and literacy-rich curriculum, do you show any data as far as the language barriers from Spanish, Hmong, how this affects them in their early child age, like kindergarten, preschool? Is there any data such as that?
I think there is.
Dr. Reynolds.
Thank you. I guess in our project, for example, we had a significant 100 Latino Spanish-speaking sample. We looked at, in terms of the impact, in terms of the curriculum, was pretty much the same in the different classrooms and for the different kids, and the impact of the experience. Curriculum, the program experience on their child development, on its test scores and the like, was the same, was similar. So we got no difference by the language background or the race ethnicity of the participants in our study, where we had about 100, a sample of 1,500, 100 of them were from Latino backgrounds. And so we didn't see a difference in the curriculum effect or in the effect of the program by that characteristic.
Can I just...
Representative Dominguez, follow up.
Just to follow up, because a lot of these preschoolers, early child development kids speak their languages at home, and I would think that would affect them coming into the schools because that their first language is a lot of times is either Hmong or Spanish or those kind of languages.
Again, do you have anything that states that, you know, that it affects them in that way?
Dr. Reynolds.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, so we have, you know, in terms of, you know, analysis looking at those differences. I mean, the one feature about the Child Parent Center program is that there's a very significant parent involvement, so there's a connection, strong involvement of the families of the parents in the running of the center and in the educational experiences the kids get. So in our experience, and I think in other programs that wouldn't have those features, I think that would be a barrier, that we need to make sure that there's a connect, and also that language barriers are removed in terms of providing the optimal learning experience. I think the advantage in the program that I've worked with for this many years is the fact that parents are seen as partners in the educational process, and that helps remove some of the barriers and also focus on the fact that parents being there in the school significant times in the day is helpful to removing those barriers where they could exist otherwise.
Okay, last question for Dr. Reynolds, Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Reynolds, I'm returning to the slide to which Representative Demmer was focused a moment ago, and you described talking about these programs, I'm wondering if you could describe some of the general characteristics. Do they meet once a week, twice a week, how long, ratios, goals, some of the characteristics of the programs that are being measured here?
Dr. Reynolds.
The characteristics would be 2.5 hours a day for at least 4 days a week. And those characteristics are based on in terms of what we know works in terms of providing high quality experiences. It have to be for a certain length of time. There's a minimum dosage that you have to have to get a significant effect on child development. And so that's what that reflects, and that we measure both the dosage and the length of the program and the intensity, contact time. Those are characteristics of effective programs. Those are characteristics that we have to judge to then determine whether programs are effective.
Thank you very much. Dr. Bailey.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to invite my colleague, Jillian Rowick, to join us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'll speak briefly in the interest of time. I have a tendency to speak fast, so let me know if I'm going too fast. I'm going to focus my comments primarily on middle and high school issues in science and the achievement gap. That's not to minimize the importance of science in the elementary grades, but as we look at trends in students' changing attitudes towards science, their achievement in science, if we look at international rankings and such as the TIMSS study, something's happened at eighth grade. The TIMSS study is an international study of math and science that looks at U.S. students compared to other students in other countries throughout the world.
And some of us are on Representative Mariani's committee, which is the policy committee that meets in the morning. A lot of us are not, but we did hear from SciMath this morning.
Great. Mm-hmm. So at eighth grade, things are happening. We're falling off in the international rankings. Students are starting to get turned off the site. So again, I'm going to focus my comments on that. The data that you see on the screen right now is from the NAEP data from 2005. The data is not disaggregated in any way by ethnicity or socioeconomic status. It merely groups students into three categories: if you're below basic in your science proficiency scores, if you're basic or proficient or above. Sounds like basic and proficient can be very misleading. What might be basic to me may not seem basic to you. So just to kind of just put some kind of definition onto that, the red bar, which marks if you're below proficient, 83% of students nationally at 12th grade are below proficient. If you're marked below proficient, you are unprepared for success in any college science courses, and that negates your entry into some of the more higher status jobs in terms of science and technology, and students are just not prepared to enter a more technologically work-oriented workplace. So there's some high stakes for being below that bar, and as I'm sure you're aware, that if you're below the bar, you're more likely to be a minority student, a low-income student, an English language learner. This kind of data gets a lot of press and a lot of interest from business and industry leaders, as they're struggling to find the kind of employees they want in a more technologically oriented workplace. And that has generated a lot of press nationally, and I'm just going to talk very briefly about two findings from a national report that came out last year, Rising Above the Gathering Storm. And for any of you who heard President Bush's remarks when he visited 3M last year and spoke to this, these are exactly the same findings. This is the report that he spoke from. The report discusses many things related to funding in scientific and basic research. I'm just going to speak to those that are pertinent to education. And the two main recommendations from this report are the need to annually recruit 10,000 science and mathematics teachers, and that we need to strengthen the skills of our current teachers with a focus on having more advanced placement and international baccalaureate, high-level advanced scientific courses available to our students. And what I'd like to do in the remaining slides is to focus our attention on those two recommendations in light of the achievement gap, which is what we're here to talk about. So this is a national data set. This comes from data from 2000, so it is a little bit older, but it's the most recent cut of the data that's available. And this is looking at the percentage of students in the United States taught by teachers without a major in the subject in which they're taught. So, for example, 67% of high school students are taught physics by someone who does not have a degree in physics. So we have a high percentage of out-of-field teaching in science throughout our schools. If you were to disaggregate that data and look at it in terms of what's happening in high-need schools where we have higher proportions of minority and low-income students, you'll find that the numbers are significantly larger there. So if you're a low-income or minority student, you are far more likely to be taught science by a teacher who does not have a major and often a minor in that field. Okay? So as we start to think about recruitment, clearly, as the numbers show, we have a problem nationally getting qualified science teachers into the classroom. But what we need to do as we think about recruiting is strategic recruiting. How do we get these qualified teachers into high-need schools? It's not just a matter of churning out more teachers. How do we prepare our teachers to work in urban schools, rural schools, high-need areas? And as we start to think about recruiting teachers, we also have to think about keeping teachers. And this slide looks at the retention problem that we have in education for new teachers actually staying in the profession. So what the data is showing us here, and this is looking at all teachers, whether elementary, secondary, urban, rural, this is not, again, disaggregated in any way. 14% of teachers leave the classroom after the first year in the profession. And as you start to look at the trend in the graph, you'll see that almost half of the teachers leave the classroom by the end of the fifth year. We have a revolving door in our schools where as fast as we prepare teachers, they are leaving. And if you're to disaggregate this data, science teachers are more likely to leave. The bar would be higher there than 46% if you were to compare that to, say, elementary teachers. And teachers are far more likely to be leaving high-need schools than they are suburban settings. Okay. And this graph also, again, shows teachers leaving the profession. What's not shown here is the mobility data, which also you have. You add to that bar by teachers who are leaving high-need schools and then staying in the profession but moving to suburban schools. So if you look at the data from the needs of minority students, the revolving door is revolving faster for those teachers. To try and not present such a doom and gloom picture about retention, there are some potential solutions that can be considered. And again, this is a look at national data. And this is looking at the impact of induction programs. So these are programs that provide mentoring for new teachers. They provide specialized professional development for new teachers. So to not just to keep teachers in the classroom, but to help them be better teachers in the classroom over the first few years. And just to very briefly kind of highlight a couple of points in that data, the top bar shows if we have no support. The teacher's given the keys to the classroom and said good luck. 42% of those teachers leave within the first year. As you go down the chart, this is increasing levels and qualities of support and mentoring for new teachers. And at the highest levels of support, we're only seeing 18% of teachers leaving the school. So there's a significant impact here of providing high-quality levels of mentoring and support for teachers. Okay. And that holds at any kind of school. So this works just as well at an urban school, as a rural school, as a suburban school. Now, I want to come back to the second point from the national report. So the first, we just very, very briefly looked at recruiting and retention issues. To look at this notion of we need more advanced placement courses. And the data here is looking at NAEP scores. This is from 2005. And this is looking at course-taking patterns of high school students and how that impacts performance on standardized tests such as the NAEP. And what you're seeing here is that the more science courses you take, the higher you'll score on your standardized achievements. Not too surprising. But what is alarming when you think about that data is that if taking chemistry and physics is showing such a significant improvement in performance on these kinds of tests, also impacts your likelihood of success as you go to college. There's a lot of other factors other than NAEP scores. Very, very few minority and low-income students have access to these classes. When you walk into a physics class, you are not going to see low-income and minority students. They do not have access to these classes. So there's an issue here about access to the kinds of science courses that students need to be successful. And I'll just summarize then what, just looking at this as an access gap of having the resources in schools available that students need to be successful, not just in science, but then taking that out into the workplace and beyond. We have an access problem for high-need students in access to highly qualified teachers. We need to get more qualified teachers into these schools. As we think about possible ways to go about doing that, I've highlighted the UTeach program, which is a multidisciplinary science teacher and mathematics teacher preparation program out of UT Austin, where they have a very strong pipeline and recruitment to get more teachers out into the schools. As we get more teachers out into the schools, we need to focus on having quality induction and mentoring programs. Some states provide funding for that. Others do not. Minnesota is a state that does not at this time fund any induction and mentoring programs. And we also need to make sure that we have access to rigorous courses and curriculum for all students. All students should have access to the kind of courses that they need to be successful and to be able to take jobs in a more technologically oriented workplace. I just gave a couple of samples there of things that research demonstrate have been successful. Providing access to middle school students to algebra would be one example of that. And Physics First, which is changing the order in which students take science classes and making sure that all students have access to physics in ninth grade rather than it becoming an elective in senior science. So I went very fast, as I know we're almost out of time, but I'm happy to take questions.
Madam Chair, is it possible to limit the questions that we could get?
I think that's a great idea. So thank you, Dr. Roering.
Thank
and
you.
On to the next person, Dr. Bailey.
Thank you very much. Mr. Deborah Dillon, please.
Dr. Dillon.
Hello. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Deborah Dillon, a professor of reading at the University of Minnesota, and also a colleague of many K-12 reading and language arts teachers across the state who I've had the pleasure of working with through several different projects and being in their classroom. And I'm here today to talk with you about the achievement gap and literacy. Many of you have heard a lot about literacy. It's been in the spotlight with quite a bit of federal funding. I wanted to start today with what our goal is for K-12 students, and I will speak from a K-12 perspective. That is that we would like to see students reading proficiently. And I wanted to bring forth the new NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, framework definition for reading, because I think it's important to undergird just where we want to head with students, and that is that reading is an active and complex process that involves understanding written text, developing and interpreting meaning, and using meaning as appropriate to type of text, purpose, and situation. And essentially there, what NAEP is trying to get at is that oftentimes we prepare students with foundational knowledge of how to read. They learn their letter sounds in the early grades, they learn how to decode words, and they learn how to read predominantly narrative texts or stories. But some of the more challenging texts that they're encountering as they go up through the grade levels is causing some problems for our students, and this is an area that we need to work on. What we really want to see students doing is becoming deeply engaged with all sorts of texts and understanding the vocabulary needed to read their content area textbooks, having the background knowledge that they need, using appropriate reading strategies when they encounter a text and knowing what to do when,
and also being able to complete particular texts that they need to for assignments or for other purposes. I wanted to start with obviously an initiative or an issue that many of us know a lot about, and that is the Reading First initiative that's pumped quite a bit of federal support into improving primary grade reading, $5 billion in particular. And these monies were used for professional development for teachers predominantly with a focus on five areas of reading instruction. And these five areas I point out as being the more foundational level knowledges and skills that we would want students to become proficient at. Phonemic awareness, knowing the difference between letters and sounds. Phonics, being able to decode and put sounds and letters together. Fluency, reading fluently to be able to make sense and comprehend texts. Vocabulary and comprehension. One important area that has been left out is the area of motivation, although it is mentioned in some of the national reading panel reports, and we found, and I'll preface in my later comments, that this is becoming much more important in students' reading development. Research at the University of Minnesota and nationwide, our research at Minnesota has been related to Reading First and what's happened because of the partnership between the Department of Education and the university in providing the professional development for teachers in our state in terms of helping with K-3 reading. And we're seeing some tremendous strides in the achievement of students who have participated in Reading First schools. First of all, these schools have a research-based literacy framework now for reading instruction. The framework guides what is taught in reading, how much time is spent in reading and writing, what these activities look like, what assessments are collected, and how the data are made sense of. This provides a coherence for teachers and allows them to really work on high-quality teaching practices. Reading First grant money affords teachers a lot of time with high-quality professional development. This is ongoing and intense. A lot of this professional development has occurred at the University of Minnesota, where teachers work with reading researchers and also with other researchers nationwide to learn the very best practices and to learn how to put those into place. But it doesn't just stop there. There's also what we refer to as job-embedded professional development, where we're able to support reading coaches who work side-by-side with teachers in their classrooms when they're working with our students that are the most difficult to teach, and really help to guide them and provide demonstrations and feedback on lessons in an immediate sort of way. The other really powerful part about Reading First is that administrators and principals are involved in the professional development. So they're there, they know what's going on, and they're supporting the practices that are occurring and really pressing schools and teachers to work hard to implement these.
Dr. Dillon, I'm just going to let you know we have 3 minutes left of our committee time, and unfortunately legislators usually are scheduled the second we're done, so we do end on time. So just you can judge your time accordingly.
Okay. With that in mind, and since I'm a literacy person, my slides are already literacy rich, so I'm going to skip this slide. And I want to move to, I think, a very important initiative in light of conversations recently about where Minnesota should head. Is it with putting a lot of emphasis on early childhood education? Is it with putting emphasis on K-3 reading? Or is it at the high school level? And might I suggest it's all of the above. What we're finding is that we're doing quite well in really supporting students' early literacy development, although we should not give up in that area. We need to keep pressing and seeing long-term efforts there. But we cannot leave students alone, if I can say that, at the fourth grade level or beyond. What we're starting to see is what's being called the fourth grade slump. And this is where students are encountering more and more difficult texts that they're not able to read, and their teachers don't have yet the skills and the abilities that we would like to see them have to really help kids work with those more difficult content area texts. Each one of the disciplines is laid out in a different way and requires different sorts of strategies. So there is a new initiative, the Striving Readers Initiative. It has not been fully funded yet, and we have no results from the few projects that have been supported. But we do know some really important things in research about what ought to happen in terms of best practices. And so I would say that this is an area that really deserves our attention here in Minnesota, very much so. It really, truly is not just a matter of putting students in the very richest classrooms with high-level kinds of content, but we really have to help them read those texts and maneuver their way through the content, and also support them as we're starting to see their motivation levels drop as they go through school. And there's proposed action steps here. There are three of them on this page and three on the next. They primarily focus on supporting teachers. This, I think, is key because we've seen with Reading First the difference that ongoing sustained professional development makes. But teachers cannot do it alone, as we've been reminded by our colleagues. We really need emphasis at various levels. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah. Well, I just want to thank all of you very much, and Richard Lawson for helping be our liaison with the university, and Dr. Bailey for bringing all these wonderful resource people. We could have spent the entire hour with any one of them, and I know I myself had about five questions more for each person, but didn't dare ask them because I knew what was coming. So I hope that members who are not scheduled tightly right afterwards can stay and ask personal questions. I know we had other legislators on the list. But Dr. Bailey, one last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for allowing us to come in and share just a pittance, if you will, of what we have gathered so far. Please let me tell you that we would be honored to continue to work with you in any collaborative partnership that you would like to put together, and please use our college as the gateway to answering questions that you may have moving forward.
And Dr. Bailey, if you could afterwards give our staff the contact information, we could share it with the committee at our next meeting.
Absolutely.
So thank you, members. Thank you, university resource people. Meeting's adjourned.